Thank you very much. I want to welcome you. Sorry, my name is Richard McGregor. I'm a senior fellow here at Lowy. I want to welcome you to the first public event at the old and now new home for the Lowy Institute. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, the traditional owners of the land, past and present. I'd also like to welcome Hugh White, our guest, whose career I can confidently say has straddled both the new and old Lowy Institute homes and well beyond, as a bureaucrat, briefly a journalist, more recently a scholar, and also something that is very rare in Australia, not just a public intellectual, but an effective public intellectual, which is probably why he gets under so many people's skin. So today we're going to talk about his new book, How to Defend Australia. The title, I think, speaks for itself. And I venture to say this book is both a pioneering work, but really from my perspective, from Hugh, I would argue long overdue. It comes out of a decade of, you know, mini books or shorter articles about the US and China, our changing circumstances, Australia's changing strategic circumstances, the rise of China, the relative decline of the US. And I think finally with this book, he's really followed a lot of those strands through to a logical argument about Australia's own defence situation. Now, Hugh, you've often complained that Canberra refuses to confront Australia's changed strategic circumstances. Is your book an indication you think that's still true, that you think your message is still not getting through?
Well, let me start by thanking you very much for your introduction, and thank you all for coming here, and it's very nice to be back in this lovely building. Yes, look, exactly as you say, Richard, this book is in many ways a culmination, or at least the latest element in a long conversation I've been having with myself and been trying to have with others about what China's rise means for Australia, because I do think China's rise is not just another day in the office. It is a fundamental shift in the distribution of wealth and power globally, and because I take a slightly mechanistic view of the way international affairs works, it seems to me that when power shifts, relationships change. When relationships change between the great powers, everything else changes around it. And that's their times of great peril. And I do think that Australia has been very slow to recognise that China's rise is not just a huge economic event, and obviously Australians are very conscious of that, but also a huge strategic event, and have been very slow to register what that means for us diplomatically and strategically and militarily. And one reason for that is that when you start to acknowledge how significant China's rise is, and in particular its implications for America's place in Asia, and therefore for America's place in our security, then, and this is one of the messages the book conveys, once you start accepting, if you accept the argument I make, that as China's power grows, it will become harder and harder for America to sustain the position in Asia, which is the foundation for its contribution to Australia's security, then we can depend less on America than we have in the past. And that has very frightening implications for what Australia has to do instead. And what the book really sets out to do is to say, well, if we can't depend on the United States in future, can we defend ourselves? And I give an answer, which is a qualified and slightly scary yes. It's a kind of a yes, but.
And that's, which basically means we spend a ton more money, at least double per GDP what we're spending now. I know you don't particularly like that measure, but in any case, spend a lot more money or take the risk that we can sort of fend for ourselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The book is not advocating that Australia should definitely go out and start spending a lot more money on a very different, much bigger kind of defence force. It is instead trying to do something which is subtly but significantly different. That is to say, if we accept that we can no longer rely on the United States in the future as we have in the past, particularly when we look 20 or 30, even 40 years ahead, and one of the big themes, of course, here is that what matters to us in the defence decisions we make over the next few years is not what we expect to be happening in Asia over the next few years, is what we expect to be happening in Asia 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, because just to take one topical example, the first of the new submarines we're buying at the moment won't hit the water before 2035 or 6 or 7, even if you believe the government's very optimistic account. The last of them won't hit the water until just about the middle of the century. So the choices we make in the next few years will shape the capabilities that we will have in the middle of the century, and we therefore have to make those decisions on the basis of prudent judgments, the best judgments we can make, about the kind of region we live in and the kind of support we should expect from the United States and others that far in the future. And my point is, we have to, if we accept that logic, then we have to ask ourselves, well, what choice could we do? Do we have the option of defending ourselves independently? And if so, what would that require? Most of the time, through most of our history, in fact, you could say through all of our history, Australians have simply taken it for granted because they've taken a quick look at the map, how big the continent is, how few we are, how populous some of our neighbours are. There's been very strong assumption that we can't defend the place independently. We haven't ever really had to test that assumption because we've always been so confident that we'll have great and powerful friends to do that for us. And my argument now we can no longer be that confident. We have to ask, well, can we defend ourselves independently? And I come up with a qualified and slightly unsettling yes to that question. We then have to ask ourselves the question, well, do we need to? Should we? Because it is going to cost us a lot more money, and it's going to require us possibly to do some things we'd much rather not do. And so we just have to make a straight judgment. In the end, it's a very normal public policy judgment. Do we assess the future risks as best we can, being sufficiently high to warrant spending the sorts of money we'd require to have the military forces to deal with those risks? And as you say, I mean, I'm a great fan of GDP share as a measure of defence spending, but it's good for some things, and it's good for the point I'm about to make. We'll have to, my judgment is we'd have to move from spending 2% of GDP to 3.5% of GDP or more. And that's a huge increase. It's not unaffordable. Australia could spend that if we wanted to. We have spent that sort of money in the past. We spent an average of 3.4% of GDP in the 1950s, for example. We could do it, but we shouldn't do it unless we choose to. On the other hand, we shouldn't just assume, if and as US support fades, that there's nothing we can do. We could do it if we wanted to. We just have to make the choice. And I'm just trying to educate, if you like, elucidate and explain that choice.
I might say one of the paradoxes of this, of course, is to build a stronger economy to afford to be able to defend ourselves against China. I know you're not just talking about China. We need China to succeed because China is so important to generate national income. So, you know, to defend, Japan is in the same position, right? So how do we manage that paradox?
Well, I think it's a really important question, and I think it reflects the way in which Australia's strategic situation is becoming more normal. For a very long time, we've been in a very unusual situation that we've had not just the dependence, the opportunity to depend on a great and powerful friend like America for our security, which has meant that in the end, you know, we've been confident that either or both that American power would prevent any major threat arising. And if it did anyway arise, then America would be there to defend it from us. So we've felt very secure, and rightly so. On the other hand, we've had the opportunity to hitch our economy to the biggest, fastest growing country the world has ever seen. We've seen economies grow quickly in the past. We've even seen big economies grow quickly in the past. We've never seen an economy this big grow this quickly for this long. And so it's been a unique opportunity for us. And that's, you know, it's true, we're a lucky country. We have had, you know, it's a simple way of putting it, but China has made us rich and America has kept us safe. And the tensions there have been resolved by the simple fact that China chose not to contest America's leading position. And therefore, that's changed. That's what changed. It was always going to change, it seems to me. You know a lot about this than I do, but embedded in Deng Xiaoping's injunction that you bide your time and hide your power is that that's a temporary thing. You're doing it for a while. And I think the historians will judge it around about 2011. And maybe it would have happened even if Xi Jinping hadn't become leader, but certainly with Xi Jinping that China decided to contest America's position and put its power to it. And so we do face that classic dilemma that the economy that we depend on and that we have helped to support through our trade is driving a country which, if it doesn't threaten us, and to be clear, I don't think China threatens Australia. I do think China threatens the strategic order which has kept Australia secure. It's a subtle but important distinction. But our dependence on China and our contribution to China's growth has helped to fuel the factor which undermines our long-term security structures. That's, you know, welcome to the real world.
And so on the foundational issue, the rise of China, the relative decline of the US, we've heard a lot in Australia from politicians, from the diplomatic community, supposedly from the intelligence community. But what about the defence and the defence bureaucracy? I mean, the Department of Defence has legions of PR people, but they've never seemed to learn how to pick up the phone. What do they think, and is what do they have an institutional view, and is it important?
Really important question, because one of the things that drove me to write the book is the sense that that Australia's defence, not just the Defence Department and the ADF, the people on Russell Hill, but the defence community more broadly, was not engaging with the implications to us of China's rise, of the relative decline of America's position in Asia, nearly vigorously enough. Now, there's a couple of reasons, of elements of the background to that. And just to make one point, I want to be clear, it's not that I think that building up Australia's armed forces is the only, or even in many ways, the most significant way Australia can respond to all of this. There's a whole lot of what I broadly call diplomacy that we need to undertake to try and shape the region and shape our role in it as best we can to improve our position as Asia changes. But I do think the military has a part of it, and it's the part of Australia's international posture that I'm most familiar with. It's where I've spent most of my time working, and it's one I'm very, very interested in as a result. So if you look at how Australia's thinking about its defence has adapted, the answer is, so far, hardly at all. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they've received very little, if any, encouragement from the top. Australia's political class, and entirely bipartisan, both sides of politics, have for a very long time, I think, very plainly refused to acknowledge the significance of what's happening in Asia. The great mantra that we hear again and again, and we're still hearing it, we don't have to choose between America and China. Well, as a statement of preference, of course that's right. Of course we don't want to choose between America and China, but that's not the point. The question is, will we have to choose between America and China? Now, we haven't had to in the past. That's what's produced that very congenial circumstance I touched on a minute ago. But whether we have to make those choices in the future, that does depend on us. That depends on them. And it does seem to me that embedded in the idea of we don't have to choose has been a set of judgments that say we won't have to choose between America and China because America and China won't really be strategic rivals because China will back off because America is so strong. That I think, even today, just scratch a little bit.
Haven't we really moved beyond that in Canberra? I don't think it's so much we don't have to choose, but we're now into the we don't want to choose. My sense in Canberra, there's widespread sort of panic about what to do about this sort of thing, but you can't easily, you know, seek from one set of circumstances to another, particularly as they're changing in front of your eyes.
Well, I had thought that we don't have to choose, that mantra had disappeared. And I thought it had disappeared, roughly speaking, in late 2017. But actually, it started reappearing again. And I think the reason why political leaders keep saying it is just because when you start to acknowledge what I think is happening, that is that China is mounting a very powerful and successful challenge to American leadership in Asia and that the chances of America succeeding and pushing back effectively are dropping and would be even without Donald Trump, but more quickly with Donald Trump, then the challenge to everything about Australia's foreign policy, everything about our defence policy, becomes very profound, and we've just been reluctant to take that on. So what that means is that defence haven't been told from Parliament House, go away and rethink Australia's defence to take account of these fundamental changes.
But they need political direction. They're not driving it from defence itself.
And they're certainly not driving it themselves. The reason they're not driving it themselves is twofold. The first is that defence has been, for understandable reasons in some ways, since the East Timor crisis of 1999, 20 years ago, and particularly since 9/11, overwhelmingly focused on a series of contemporary military operations. Now, you don't criticise a military organisation for focusing on the operations that are happening day by day.
Right now in Iraq, right?
Right now. Well, Iraq, you know, and of course, all of the stuff we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, the operations against ISIS more recently and so on. I mean, these are naturally preoccupying. However, a defence organisation does have two jobs. One is to fight today's wars, and the next is to prepare for the future ones. And I do think defence has not been willing to really think these things through. And one of the other reason for that, apart from being preoccupied with contemporary operations, is that when you start to think it through, you end up with something with a vast slaughter of sacred cows. You do have to rethink a lot of Australia's defence policy from the ground up. And one of the things about the book is that I do try and set out in a fairly systematic way, going back to basics, how would you design a defence force for the independent defence of Australia, by asking what do we really need our armed forces to do, what kind of operations would you undertake to do those things, what kind of capabilities you need to perform those operations, and how could you best deliver them. And the answer, I believe, is pretty clear and very different. The role for the army looks very different, and the structure of the navy.
But it's almost a start from scratch exercise.
It is,
which would be horrifying for any bureaucracy.
It is. I mean, all bureaucracies are naturally conservative. Military bureaucracies are more conservative than most. There are very big organisational and almost cultural equities involved, and so I'm not surprised that defence hasn't done this yet. But I do think that it's past time that they should have. And again, one of the hopes I have for the book, I guess, is that a few people on Russell Hill start thinking, oh, okay, maybe we should rethink this. And I guess worth making a third point, and that is that defence, I think, on Russell Hill, as much as anywhere else in Australia, there's a bit of a tendency to think we can't do this. You very often, in conversations with my, you know, former colleagues, and I hope still friends in defence, is that they say, well, look, you know, we simply can't do this without the United States. There's a stronger sense of psychological dependence on the United States today than I think there was, than I know there was when I first started in this business in the 1980s. And it's interesting why that should be the case. But the fact is that I think one of the factors we're dealing with is our defence organisation, and more broadly our defence community, are reluctant to acknowledge the responsibility they carry for preparing Australia to defend itself in a much more difficult and complex environment. And so, you know, they're pretty strong psychological as well as institutional inhibitions getting this job done. But on the other hand, I don't think the defence community is doing its job by Australia if it doesn't acknowledge that the things that have worked for us in the past aren't going to work for us in the future.
So looking at China, I wouldn't say that you've been, and you don't do this work yourself, overly optimistic on the Chinese economy. I think it's quite fair to see the Chinese economy continuing to grow. But I wonder, in one thing you don't seem to follow through as a threat, is China's ability as a hegemonic power, as a dominant power.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, any hegemon has to learn. That's fair enough. But the idea that China can take America's place in Asia seems quite misplaced when you think about, you know, they've got territorial disputes with Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, even little Brunei and the like.
Yep.
And so if China does become dominant, they'll be dominant. And at the same time, as Xi Jinping says, we will not give up a single inch of land, as much as that's a negotiating position. China's going to dominate a very unhappy, a very fractious region. Look at Hong Kong and Taiwan once they feel the encroaching shadow of the PRC. What will this do to the domestic politics of all the other Southeast Asian nations, let alone Australia?
Yeah.
And it seems to me this is a little bit of an unknown, and also a bit of a crack in the sort of potential Chinese dominance.
Yeah, no, really good point. And I mean, two ways into it. The first is, obviously, we don't know what kind of regional hegemon China might become. Now, just to be clear on one thing, I do not think China is going to end up dominating the globe, certainly, nor even Asia writ large, nor the Indo-Pacific, that concept which is so popular in Canberra and Washington these days. I simply don't think China can compete effectively, at least in the long term, with India for the primary position in South Asia and the Indian Ocean. What it can do, I think, is compete effectively with the United States and with other potential rivals in East Asia and the Western Pacific to become the dominant power in that area, East Asia, Western Pacific. Now, what kind of hegemon, predominant power would it be? Well, it's going to be different from the United States, that's for sure. There are lots of different ways of doing the hegemonic thing. And I don't, and I completely agree with you, there are lots of reasons why China would end up inevitably doing it differently. Apart from anything else, it is a local power. And it's very different having a local hegemon from having an extra-regional hegemon separated from the region by a vast ocean. One of the reasons why we've all been so happy with American hegemony has been that precisely it's been an external power which has had, which has given it a lot of advantages. So the first point to make is however China, if China ends up as the leading power in East Asia and the Western Pacific, and I think it most likely will, then it will function differently and I think less congenially than the United States has. And it's partly because it has got such more complex and difficult relations with so many other key players, and Japan most obviously. So the second way of looking at it is to look at it from the rest of our point of view. And, you know, all of us face a really tough challenge. The conversations that we're starting to have in Australia are echoed all over East Asia because we all enormously value our relationship with China. This is not like the Soviet Union during the Cold War, where the Soviet Union, the vast majority of people in the West, just looked like a very serious threat and offered very little. China is doesn't pose as serious a threat as the Soviet Union does. There's a lot of things about China that we worry about, and legitimately, but it doesn't look as aggressive or threatening as the Soviet Union did, ideologically, quite apart from anything else. But on the other hand, it's also much more attractive. Everybody wants to get on well with China. Everybody, certainly Australia, but I think everybody in the region, sees China, the opportunities of China's market, as the principal source of economic opportunities for their economy. And so we all very much want to get on with China at the same time as being worried about it. So this is unusual for us. It's the first time in Australia's history, this is now a pretty familiar line, that our biggest trading partner and our biggest potential trading partner has not been a close ally. But in the grand sweep of history, it's pretty normal. We're just going to have to balance those things as are other countries. But what that means is it's a very important implication for the way in which the power politics of East Asia play out over the next couple of decades, because it's going to make it much harder to assemble coalitions to resist China's preponderance or hegemony than people would think. You know, if you look at it through a sort of Cold War analogy, you think, well, this is just going to be like what happened in the late 40s and early 50s, and all the other countries in Asia, you know, Japan and South Korea and Indonesia and Singapore and Australia and New Zealand and maybe India as well, are all going to gang up to contain China's power. I think that's very unlikely, because we all, including Australia, are so committed to preserving our relationship with China that the threshold for us to support another country in their blues with China is going to be very high.
And I mean, you don't talk about just about China in your book, obviously.
No.
Let's take another one, Indonesia, for example.
Yes.
And you know, say that can be both, as you were just talking about, potentially, with difficulty, an ally with Australia against bigger powers in the region, but also a potential adversary as well.
Yeah.
I mean, is that correct? I mean,
there
seems to be any number of permutations and combinations once the existing order drains away.
Yeah, no, look, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's very common for people in my position and people, you know, intelligence analysts and so on, to talk about growing complexity. But this is actually... some aspects of what's happening in Asia is not complex. I think it's very simple. Like the rise of China is a very big, simple, relatively easily comprehended phenomenon. But there are going to be a lot of complex byplays within it. And for Australia, none of these are going to be more important than Indonesia. Indonesia preserves the position it's always had of being, well, since it's become independent, of being the only one of Australia's close neighbours, and therefore the only country that can cause Australia a military threat directly from its own territory, or substantial military threat, which is big enough to do that. I mean, all our other close neighbours are very small and weak. And so Indonesia's always had a special place in our strategic horizon, but it becomes much more important in future because of the way its economy is growing. You know, perfectly plausible estimates, validated, I think, by the Power Index. Is that right? Yes. Yes, it is validated. Indonesia is probably going to be the fourth biggest economy in the world well before the middle of the century.
It's on PPP terms, I think.
On PPP terms, yeah, but PPP, in my business, PPP is what counts. And probably actually even in market exchange rates by the middle of the century. I mean, it's just because of its population. It's got the fourth biggest population. Grow steadily away at 5%, 6%, 7%. Eventually you get there. Now, we have no experience of living next door to a country with an economy much bigger than ours, but that's going to be a new experience for us. So quite apart from the whole story about China, there's a whole story about Australia living next door to this very complex, very unclear country. Very hard to see how Indonesia uses the power that accrues to it as its GDP grows, what kind of country it becomes. But it is true that Indonesia will end up being both the country which has got the greatest potential to threaten Australia, because it's closest, and also the greatest potential as a partner with Australia, as an ally with Australia, in dealing with more distant threats coming from China or wherever, because our interests are more naturally aligned because it's closest to us. And so all the ambivalence that we've always had about Indonesia, the 1976 Defence White Paper, one of the great documents in the history of Australian strategic policy, had a great line that said Indonesia will always, because of its geography, Indonesia will always have some of the characteristics both of a strategic asset and a strategic liability. That was very true then. It's even more true in future.
But we have to put that ambivalence to the side and really work hard to get close to it.
I would say that naturally, a lot of people in responding to the book have said, you know, Australia shouldn't be trying to do this stuff by itself. It should be working as hard as it can to build relations with other countries. Well, I think it's quixotic and naive to imagine that we can just pick up Japan and South Korea and all these other countries and assume that they're prepared to yoke their oxen to our strategic plough. But Indonesia is the country with which you have the best chance, precisely because it's closest, and therefore it's what threatens Indonesia threatens us most directly and vice versa. On the other hand, as we know, because they're so close, it's a relationship which we find very hard to manage, and which I think as a country we've done a bad job of managing. So that's a long way of saying yes. Mm. For us, the strategic imperative of making the relationship with Indonesia work a hell of a lot better than it has in the past gets stronger and stronger the less we can depend on others. I make the point in the book, and I've made the point before, that it's perfectly credible, though it requires a big stretch of the imagination for us to see this, perfectly credible that Indonesia will be Australia's most important ally in 20 or 30 or 40 years' time, simply because it's the closest and it's going to be big and powerful, but it could also be a very significant challenge to us. So the whole argument, and that's why it's important, the Richard point, that China is a natural focus for the debate in some ways, but it's far too narrow just to see China as the only feature of our strategic horizon.
So let's move now to the South Pacific, and maybe your argument here is overly nuanced, but it also seemed to me a little bit at odds in many respects. On the one hand, you say we've got to have the Pacific step up. On the other hand, you say, well, don't bother because we can't keep China out anyway.
Mm.
And that, I guess, is based on your assertion that we want that to be our exclusive strategic domain.
Yes.
I've not heard anybody in Australia say that we want the Pacific, along with New Zealand, I guess, to be our exclusive strategic domain. So I just wonder how you get to that point. Maybe it's highly nuanced. Maybe we have to put the effort in there but accept China in as well. Is that what it is?
Yeah, look, it's a really important question, and I've been written about this not just in the How to Defend Australia book but also in the recent issue of Australian Foreign Affairs. Just to take it back to the operational level, it is true, and I make a point of this in the book, that, and it's always been true, it's true ever since Australians first started thinking about the defence of the continent in, roughly speaking, the 1870s, it became clear that our remoteness is a great advantage to us strategically, as long as we remain remote. That is, as long as, because we're so far from major powers that could potentially threaten us. But if a major power could secure bases in the islands close to Australia, it made it a lot easier for them to mount an attack on us. And you can see, very first generation of Australian political leaders, in the mid-19th century, starting to recognise this and therefore starting to obsess about other countries getting access, like Germany and France, for example, in establishing colonies in what became PNG and Vanuatu and New Caledonia and so on. And that's remained the sort of foundational position in Australian foreign policy, strategic policy ever since. And I mean, okay, perhaps you haven't heard Australian politicians say exactly the formulation you just used, but successive white papers have used a formulation which goes, Australia would be extremely concerned by any intrusion by a potentially hostile major power into the islands in our immediate neighbourhood. That's a very close paraphrase, if not a direct quote from the 2000 white paper. And exactly the same language continues to be reproduced and in earlier white papers. And when Malcolm Turnbull opened his Sydney Morning Herald sometime in April last year and saw David Rowe's story about Vanuatu seeking a military base in China seeking a military base in Vanuatu, not the other way around. that'd be interesting.
Vanuatu,
then he said something like, Australia would be very concerned by the intrusion of any potentially hostile major power into our immediate neighbourhood. I mean, it was just a perfectly, you know, precise restatement of that canonical position. Now, and this does pose a very real challenge to Australian policy for generations. For as long as we've had a strategic policy, our aim has been to make sure that no potentially hostile major power gets a position in our immediate neighbourhood. But, and that, it's worth making a point, with the very notable exception of the Germans and the French did. The Germans turned into an enemy. We managed to dispose of the Germans in the first weeks of World War One, and they didn't come back. The Japanese, of course, did. It caused us a lot of drama in the 1940s. Since then, it's worked pretty well. But we have never faced a regional power as powerful as China. And so if China chooses to establish a diplomatic position or even a military position in the Southwest Pacific, is going to be much harder for us to sustain that policy of exclusion than it has been for us in the past. And the question that I think we need to ask now is it sensible for us to respond to China's growing power and growing interest in its position in the Southwest Pacific by trying to go back to what you might call the old-fashioned Alfred Deakin doctrine of keeping them out? Is that going to work? Or is it better for us to say, okay, well, we're just going to have to accept that this is a very big and powerful country, that the countries of the Southwest Pacific, just like us, are going to want to build good relations with China, are going to want to welcome Chinese investment, are even going to be interested in having the occasional Chinese investment in their port facilities. You know, that's not something we're in a position to say they shouldn't do. And so I think for Australia to try and return to restore the old policy of exclusion, exclusive sphere of influence, is misguided. And I do think a lot of what we've seen in the Pacific step-up under Turnbull first and then very clearly under Morrison is too strongly just sort of reflexively going back to a restoration of that old, what I call the Deakin Doctrine, and is not sufficiently recognising the fact that actually China is going to end up with a stronger position in the region. And if it chooses to have a military element to that, then I think it's going to be very hard to stop them. That's the bad news. The good news, and this goes back to the point about the technical points about defence policy that I raise in the book, is that it's not actually that hard for Australia to deal with those sorts of bases in our immediate neighbourhood if it actually comes to a fight, which is a remote contingency, but one that defence policy has to contemplate. One of the ways in which military affairs have changed since Alfred Deakin's days is that it's easier for us now than it was then to deal with that kind of intrusion. So I think the intrusion is both less serious operationally and less and much harder to resist diplomatically or economically, and we should therefore drop the old sphere of influence, exclusionary sphere of influence model of dealing with it, and start, to be blunt, being more accommodating.
I guess if we're going to do that, then we have to do so from a position of strength. But I'm not going to get you to answer that. I think we're past 1:30 now, so we're going to have questions.
So the idea about the submarines, which you mentioned,
yes,
the idea that we buy, was it 12 French, yes, and then they're nuclear submarines, but we gut out the nuclear and somehow
right,
we fudge in a diesel electric. Why is no one questioning how insane that is?
I am. Look, don't get me started. But we got off the rails badly with the project to replace the old Collins. by thinking that what we wanted to do was to build the perfect submarine for ourselves that had everything we wanted. And, you know, the thing about things that are perfect is that they end up being unaffordable, and unaffordable both financially but also in terms of risk and schedule and so on. So we've committed ourselves to buying a submarine which is bigger than we need and more innovative than we need, because we didn't subject our planning to the real rigor and discipline of saying, we don't want something that's perfect, we want something that's going to work and work soon, work on time. So I do think and I have a section in the book which is shorter than it used to be but still quite long, in which I unpack what I think's gone wrong with the submarine project. And my own view is that the present project is very ill-conceived, and that we need more submarines. I have a little bit of arithmetic there to justify this, saying we need 24 or 32 submarines. We need them; they can be smaller, but we need them much faster. And so I suggest that we should go back to the Collins design and evolve the design we have, because that's the design of submarine that we know best in the world. Therefore, the technical risks are lower and we can move ahead faster.
So I'm just going to I'm not wearing a watch is fatal. I've gone to questions a little bit early, so I'm going to ask one more before we go back to questions, if I may, because I think we need to hear Hugh on this. The book does talk about whether Australia should get nuclear weapons. It doesn't say Australia should get nuclear weapons. That often doesn't come across in press coverage for obvious reasons. So just quickly, Hugh, give us your sense of the debate, your sense of the debate of the issues about whether or not to get nukes.
Yeah. Look, thanks, Richard. It's an important part of the book, and as you say, it has attracted a fair amount of attention, which doesn't surprise me.
It was the only thing the Global Times was interested in.
Look, it's the proposition is as simple as this. It's made absolute sense for Australia to resile from any thought of acquiring nuclear capability for itself for the 50 years since we negotiated and signed and ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because the costs, all kinds of costs, financial, diplomatic, moral, technical, of acquiring nuclear weapons are very high, and the benefits would have been over the last 50 years very low, because we had such good reason to believe that US extended nuclear deterrence would protect us from any nuclear attack or threat. And so it just made no sense at all for Australia to take that route. But if I'm right in my pessimistic view of the future of America's position in Asia, then I believe that our confidence in US extended nuclear deterrence declines. We can be less confident that the US would defend us from a nuclear threat or attack in future. And therefore, the potential benefits rise to Australia, or the disbenefits of not having nuclear weapons rise, because our capacity to respond to manage nuclear threats without US support would be so low without them. Now, I'm myself far from sure that they rise far enough to mean that on balance we should look at acquiring nuclear weapons. I think I still think the costs are very high, and I'm very far from being sure that we should, subsisting without the capacity, that we now have, or the benefit we now have from the US of extended nuclear deterrence, that it wouldn't just be better to live with that threat. But I do think that's a debate we have to have. And I think we have to acknowledge that the security that we've acquired, that we've been endowed with through US extended nuclear deterrence, if it's not available to us in future, is going to change the balance in cost and risk, and that's a debate we need to have. Now, once you take it into that, a lot of subordinate issues come to the fore. There's a very big question about whether an Australian nuclear deterrent could be effective in deterring a potential attack, and that's a big question on which people like Gareth Evans, for example, I've had big debates with Gareth about this. And of course, there's the overarching question as to whether or not, under any circumstances, we could be morally justified in using either the use or threat of nuclear weapons under any circumstance, the kind of moral pacifism, nuclear pacifism argument. And I think, and I myself am a bit agnostic on both of those issues. So it's very far from being an argument that says we should acquire nuclear weapons. It is an argument that says the basis upon which we've resiled from nuclear weapons in the past has shifted, along with everything else, as China's power grows and as America's position in Asia weakens, and we're therefore going to need to go back and revisit that issue. There's also a connection between that argument and the argument about conventional weapons that I talked about before. It may be that if Australia can't find a way, decides against the nuclear option, then it would make less sense for us to build the conventional forces to be able to defend ourselves independently, because against any nuclear power there'd be a significant risk that our capacity, that our conventional forces could be neutralised by nuclear blackmail. And so there's a connection between the two. I think in the end Australia may end up, I'm not sure about this, but may end up facing a choice between building substantial conventional forces and a small nuclear deterrent capability, or taking what I unkindly and unfairly refer to as the New Zealand option, which is just relying on our geographical isolation to keep ourselves safe and hoping for the best.
And one final question. We talk and think a lot about potential Chinese economic coercion.
Mm.
You know, we've got the thermal coal issue going on at the moment. But what about if we do move away from the US? What about US coercion, or the ability of the US to put pressure on us? We rely on the US or get a great deal of intelligence from the US, which we couldn't replicate ourselves. We are tied into US defense technology in a way which is very difficult to extricate ourselves from. So if we do take a switch policy and the US is unhappy, what could the US do to Australia?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. You're absolutely right, and I talk about it quite a lot in the book. We have a very heavy dependence on US technology and intelligence and so on, and the technology in particular would continue to be extremely important to us as we tried to build more independent defence forces. And one of the things we need to do, I think, is to spend a lot of money on enhancing our capacity to maintain our own forces independently, and quite a lot of the extra money that I see being required to build that independent strategic position would be not just on buying more stuff, but on building the capacity to look after it and keep it fighting independently without US support.
And hopefully all that capacity is not in South Australia, is it?
As it happens, quite a lot of it would end up being South Australia. But at any rate, there's a very it's a very big bill there. But that wouldn't in any way detract from the fact that America would, or we would hope it would, continue to be a very significant source for defence technology and so on. And that's going to mean that whatever happens, no matter, even with my gloomiest depictions of America's future in Asia, America is still going to be an incredibly powerful country. It's still going to have interests in Asia. It's still going to be potentially a valuable partner for us, not the kind of partner it's been in the past, but potentially a valuable partner. So one of the things we really have to attend to is what kind of defence relationship and what kind of broader relationship we want to have with an America which is no longer the dominant power in Asia. It's not as though if it stops being the dominant power in Asia, we lose interest in it altogether. We are going to have to work pretty hard at that. And part of that is to make sure that the separation between Australia and America as allies, which I think is very likely to happen, shouldn't stop us being good friends. And that's, you know, easy to say, but it'd be quite hard to manage. And one of the challenges to Australian statecraft over the next years and decades is not just to build a relationship with China that works well when China does become the preeminent power in East Asia, but to build a relationship with the United States, a new relationship with the United States, which works well when the United States is no longer playing that role.
Mm. That's a learning curve for them as well, I think.
Oh, yes, okay. Absolutely. And they might not... It might not be a graceful curve, you know what I mean?
Okay. Question there?
I have two questions kind of related, I believe. Earlier in this talk, you mentioned the causality between the economic success of China and the money Australia can have to develop our own defense against China.
Yes.
So in that sense, it sounds like we need to wait and keep making money from China in order to develop our own. But China, I think, meanwhile, is also known for stealing technologies from other countries. So in this sense, I think the longer we wait, the a stronger China would be, dealing with us.
Yes.
So my first question is, how would you address this issue? Secondly, what if China turns aggressive to other country by invading, say, Taiwan, which is probably very likely? So if China turns aggressive first, how would that change the situation in Asia Pacific or the world?
Yeah.
So you've taken us off the deep end on a couple of issues there. On the first one, the right at the heart of Australia's predicament, and it's not unique to Australia, but that's the one that's relevant to us, is that we have to start preparing to respond to a very different Asia and a very different China, whose nature we don't yet understand. We can't tell. We don't know what kind of a power China is going to become. And so we can't afford to wait until it becomes clearer what kind of power China becomes before we start making preparations, because by then it'll be too late. And so, you know, perhaps China will be an entirely kind, gentle, lovable regional hegemon, and we'll just be fine with it. And I don't say that flippantly. It's perfectly possible that would happen. There are very many examples in history of that happening. Most hegemons tend to start using their elbows pretty vigorously, but it's possible. I don't think, and so, you know, that our methodology should not be to assume the worst, but it certainly shouldn't be to assume the best either. And that's why we face this challenge, which is, you know, implicit in your question, that we have to start thinking about some of these things against the possibility that China goes one way, when in fact it might go the other. On the point of technology, I don't put as bigger emphasis on the way in which China is acquiring technology as what it's doing with it. And that is that one of the characteristics of China's forced development over the last couple of decades has been that they've done, to my mind, looking at it as a defence planner, an exceptionally good job of building exactly the forces they need to achieve the strategic objectives they've set themselves. China has certainly gained enormously by importing technology, whether by entirely honourable or slightly dishonourable means. But I don't think we should imagine that cutting off China's access to technology from overseas is going to stop it. I think we're now at a point where China has a very robust, self-sustaining capacity for technological innovation. And so I think whatever happens, we should be planning on the expectation that China will be a much more technologically capable country 20 or 30 years from now than it is. Look, on the issue of Taiwan, let's just go straight to that. Let me start slightly more broadly. How the region responds to China and how far Australia can cooperate with other countries in responding to China depends a lot on how China behaves. The more aggressive and assertive China becomes, the more China in the decades to come looks like Stalinist Soviet Union, very harsh, you know, trying to establish a very harsh militarized hegemony, then the more worried the rest of us will be, and the more willing the rest of us will be to sacrifice our individual relations with China as countries in order to cooperate together against it. It'll be more like the Cold War and the Soviet Union. But the less threatening and aggressive China looks, the less inclined we will all be to sacrifice our individual connections. And so if China suddenly, you know, sort of branched out and tried to invade Japan, then I think there'd be pretty strong grounds for building a regional coalition to resist it. But I don't think we should... China could be a very disruptive and uncomfortable hegemon and potentially quite a threatening one without being that overt. And I think that the risk... That the scenario I think is most likely is one in which China does become disconcertingly assertive without becoming so overtly aggressive that it drives the rest of the region together. And I therefore think we've got a fair chance of having to end up facing China's assertiveness separately. Taiwan, though, is a very special case. And I think Taiwan, so to speak, breaks all the rules. I think it's an extremely tragic situation. I think the chances of the rest of the world, including the United States, being able to respond effectively to a Chinese military action against Taiwan are very low. The Chinese just have too many advantages. It's not that I think it'd be easy. I think it'd be an extremely difficult thing for China to do, but there are just too many advantages to China, too many disadvantages to everybody else. And so if Taiwan ends up being the test case for the future of Asia, then it's going to be a very grim future indeed.
Thanks, Hugh. Stilgherian, I'm a journalist, and cybers is my area of interest.
Yep.
You're almost dismissive of the cybers in the book. There's maybe three or at most four pages that even mention it.
Yep.
So why are you so dismissive, if you can expand on that? And also, what should Australia do in that regard in the context of your plan? Yep.
Well, thanks for the question. It's a very good point, and I wrestled with this issue. There was a whole chapter at one stage, and then I got parsimonious and whittled it away. But look, the reason it's not so much that I'm dismissive of cyber is that I'm still very serious about old-fashioned armed force. And one of the things I find in the debate about cyber is that people tend to presume that, and people often quite say, that the wars of the future will be cyber wars. Really? I wish we could be so lucky. Nobody's told any governments. The United States is still building aircraft carriers fit to bust. The Chinese are still building combat aircraft and missiles fit to bust. So I think the proposition that future conflicts will take place in cyberspace rather than in the boring old real world is just too optimistic. The second point is that I think I'm sceptical of the strategic value of cyber offensives. And right at the heart of the idea that cyber will play a significant part in future conflicts is the thought that by attacking other countries' cyber assets or infrastructure, you can cause them so much pain that you'll really change their conduct in fundamental ways. I mean, in effect, is what strategy is all about. And this reminds me a bit of the way in which people talked about air power in the decades between the First and Second World Wars, where there was a very strong assumption that a bomber will always get through and that a bomber dropping 5,000 tons of bombs on the other country's capital would simply destroy the morale of the opposing country and force it to concede without the armies and navies ever meeting one another. And you can see in the way people talk about cyber these days something of the same idea, that you know, by the time the cyber warriors have done their thing, and you know, you've taken down my air traffic control system and I've taken down your power distribution system, then both countries will be so, you know, traumatized that we'll pull back from the conflict. Well, what we discovered in World War II is that societies, including Western societies, are appallingly tough, and you can inflict terrible damage on them without changing their behaviour. So actually the bombers did get through. The Germans killed 40,000 Brits in the Blitz. We killed maybe 300,000 Germans. We, the Allies, killed 3,000 Germans in the bombing campaigns. And we, the Allies, probably killed 500,000 Japanese. And it made no difference. Well, it made no difference at all to Germany at all, as far as one can see. And it made very little difference to Japan until the nuclear weapons were used. And even then, what role the nuclear weapons actually had is hard to assess. So I, you know, my conclusion is, yeah, sure, you can close down my air traffic control system or my sewerage system or my banking system, but will that stop me keeping on fighting? I think that's unclear. So I think the chances of any cyber conflict continuing escalating up into a conventional conflict, and the conventional conflict becoming the dominant one, and then potentially to a nuclear conflict, remains very high. And so the second point is, what do we have to do about it? It's not, nothing in that argument suggests we don't need to be able to fight a cyber campaign. We do. The beauty of cyber is it's cheap. You buy a lot of cyber for $1 billion, and we're going to get, our submarines are going to cost $4 billion a copy. I mean, give me a break. So sure, I mean, nothing I'm saying we should not invest in cyber. Of course we should. And my own view is you need to invest very heavily in offensive cyber, because I think it's a classic field in which deterrence is likely to be very effective. I can stop you closing down my air traffic control system the more I can convince you that I'll just close down your water supply system if you do. And I actually think it's an area in which deterrent balance might loom large. So it's not that I don't think it's there or important, but I think that it's actually relatively easy to deal with and relatively cheap compared to all this other stuff.
Okay, we're going to have two more questions asked simultaneously. I'm sorry, is it there, woman there, and then Jonathan in the front.
Capability is not the same as nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Australia is now quite expensive for energy, is importing diesel, and in the debate, early debate as to whether we had submarines, it was a debate that we didn't have the nuclear capabilities that Canada had developed in the 1950s. Mm. So my questioning is the debate about submarines or whatever would be well enhanced by understanding more of what it does to create the intellectual horsepower to develop nuclear capability in a situation where climate change is with us, and even if it isn't with us, energy issues are with us.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Yeah. So we've spent a lot of time today talking about a very scary scenario, but unlikely scenario in direct conflict with China. If we start preparing whole hog for that scenario, do we not run the risk of preventing our capability or reducing our capability to respond to less scary but more likely scenarios? Humanitarian crisis, state failure, terrorism, transnational crime, on and on.
No, really good point. Junie, the question about nuclear capability, and there's a couple of elements in this. Yes, for a country of Australia's kind, and particularly considering how much uranium we have a very low stock of nuclear expertise, and that's partly because of deliberate decisions the successive Australian governments have taken over a very long time. Now, opinions differ as to how hard it would be for Australia to build that capability up, and whether that was towards nuclear weapons or nuclear power or nuclear propulsion for submarines. Some people I speak to tell me that it's actually easier than one might imagine. I don't profess to know, if you know what I mean. I just note that some people say it would take us a decade and some people say it would take us many decades. And there's a whole separate argument about the imperatives to do that from an energy perspective, and that's above my pay grade. But I'll just make a point about nuclear propulsion for submarines. A lot of people tend to think that there are two kinds of submarine nations. There's the countries that have nuclear-propelled submarines who are the serious ones, and the people who have silly old diesel-electric submarines who aren't really serious. Actually, for my money, I have no aversion to the idea of a nuclear-propelled submarine. I just don't think they're cost-effective. Nuclear-propelled submarines are very handy in some applications, and they have some advantages in lots of applications. But in the core but they are expensive to run. And for my money, what matters more for us is that we have larger numbers of submarines out there. Quantity has a quality all its own, as Zhukov said. And so that's why I want 24 or 32. Now, we could arguably build 6 or 8 nuclear submarines for the price of 12 of these French ones, but we certainly couldn't build 24 or 32. And so I think the argument in favour of Australia sticking to diesel electric is very strong. I just wouldn't stick with the present ones. Jonathan, the point about the absolutely classic defence planning dilemma, which one never escapes and must always pay attention to. To what extent do you plan your forces for the very low probability but very high consequence situation out there, and to what extent you build them for the things you might be doing all the time? As it happens, in our situation, the choice doesn't quite arise because because of the way our strategic geography and the operational circumstances we're working within, Australia does in the end need kind of two defence forces, one for high level conflict, and that's overwhelmingly an air and naval force. We have a fundamentally maritime environment, overwhelming role, not just in our own continent, but through East Asia more generally. And so any Australian capacity to fight the remote but very serious major war scenario is going to focus on our air and maritime capability. We also have, and identify this quite clearly in the book, a particular focus on stabilisation in the immediate neighbourhood, and that we have a specific strategic objective for being able to contribute, use armed forces along with other instruments of policy to help stabilise the immediate neighbourhood, and the sort of thing we've done repeatedly in Solomons and East Timor and potentially in PNG and so on. And so, and I do specifically say we should design our army and the air and maritime forces required to deploy it and those sorts of operations as a whole priority in its own right. So, I recommend that we end up with a bigger army than we have at the moment, lighter but bigger, precisely because I think our army at the moment is not big enough to perform those functions. So, you don't have to make a stark choice as long as you're prepared to spend the dough. And my 3.5% of GDP defence budget encompasses quite a big capability to undertake those sorts of operations.
Let's do one more question. The gentleman at the back who was very keen.
My question really relates to the follows up from what Richard was saying about can we withstand the pressure from the United States to do what they want? And my feeling, I'd like to have you answer that, but there are two following things in mind. Our Prime Minister standing proudly on the deck of the Ronald Reagan in the exercise Taliban, and also being invited to a state dinner in Washington. It seems to me that he's going to be blandished or pressured to either join an American force in Iran or step up a naval patrols in the Pacific.
Look, on that I'm probably a little bit less pessimistic than you are, Richard. And you know, I usually do try and be the gloomiest bloke in the room, but I think, and usually I do pretty well. Look, what struck me about Morrison so far, and for that matter about Turnbull before him, has been the extent to which, since America declared China as a strategic rival, which is worth recalling, only happened in the December 2017 US National Security Strategy, but since then, Australian governments have very, to my mind, very explicitly distanced themselves from that proposition. And Morrison, in fact, we were having a discussion about this before he came down. Morrison, to my mind, did that again, for example, in his very strong endorsement of Lee Hsien Loong's speech at the Singapore Shangri-La Dialogue, which is an absolutely crackerjack speech which everyone should read. And then when Morrison himself gave his big AsiaLink speech just before he went off to the G20, It seemed to me he used language which strongly distanced himself from the emerging narrative in Washington that America and China are strategic rivals, and instead he was saying that the America and China should not see their relationship as zero sum and should work much more together. Now that is no longer what people want to hear in Washington, and so I interpret Morrison's invitation to a state dinner in the White House not as a sign that he's a favoured son, but that is a sign that he's a squeaky wheel that needs a bit of oil applied to him. Now, it certainly is my observation that the policy community in Washington are very conscious of the fact that they're in danger of losing Australia, because our interests in our relationship with China are so strong that we don't want to risk alienating China by signing up too strongly to the US view. And that this has become acute since the United States' view against China became so stark. So for what it's worth, I'm allowing myself to be optimistic that Morrison is at least aware enough of what's going on. And, of course, the guys in Beijing will remind him, if he forgets, that Australia's future depends on maintaining an equidistant position between the two. And this does have a bit of history. John Howard, when he welcomed Hu Jintao to address the Australian Parliament, the first non-American president to be accorded that honour, did say that it would always be Australia's position when the US and China differed to emphasise to both of them how important it was to get on with one another. That is, he positioned Australia equidistantly between the US and China, and it seems to me that's roughly speaking where Morrison is still trying to put us. Now, if you're in Washington, and you're looking at Australia as, you know, the 100 years of mateship ally, they don't want us to be equidistant. They want us on their side. And I tend to think there's quite acute dissatisfaction in Washington at the moment, and I think that's unlikely to change over dinner. I certainly hope it won't, because anyone who thinks that you can do old-fashioned, reliable diplomacy with that gentleman is kidding themselves.
Well, on that note... Thank you very much, Hugh. And I think Hugh's books are on sale outside. Somebody look at me and yes. Thank you once again, Hugh. Terrific to have you. And thanks, everybody, for coming along today.
Yes, thank you for coming.